I think it just, The Brutalist just feels like a very American film, even though it has the imprimatur of being this international production. And it was, and it was shot in Hungary, I think. But it just feels very American's view of what a serious 60s foreign filmmaker would do. It just feels, it has that level of pretension to it, because it just feels so American. That's what I felt as a non-American being.
Have seen this. I always have to qualify. You have seen it, right? Yeah. Okay. So what was your reaction, if I may ask, when... Go ahead.
I like the first half.
I know, we're talking about this, but...
But my primary issue with it is that is my issue with and my skepticism towards Bradley Corbet, and I think it's Corbet, right. or Brady Corbet, sorry, as a whole, which is that he's a theorist, and he imposes a theory on the screenplay and a theory on the film, and he puts all these puzzle pieces together to satisfy that theory, but that theory only takes him so far. So that's why you have the extremities of what happens in the second half, because, you know, he's just trying to impose these ideas, capitalism bad, the immigrant community exploited, etc. In a way that is just, it just seems shallow. It just seems shallow to me.
Right.
And that final sequence just annoyed me. It annoyed me. It was like, that's it? That's what it comes down to? You whining about, you know, financiers not respecting enough of your vision? You're conflating the Holocaust with, you know, your petty issues with, you know, that just seemed bizarre to me. And it just seemed very American and it's just very smug. And just it felt like cultural tourism.
In a way that I like that cultural tourism.
So I liked The Brutalist enough. I liked the performances, I think, much more than you did. But at the end of the day, you know, that second half is brutal, and I felt like I would had been betrayed in a way, because it had gone back to what I thought of Brady Corbet in the first place, which is that he just imposes theories onto stories as opposed to tell stories, works with the parameters of drama. He doesn't do that. He just, this is my theory, here you go.
Do you happen to, are you of the belief that Adrian Brody is going to prevail over Ralph Fiennes and Timothée Chalamet?
Yeah.
You do?
I think it's interesting. He doesn't have a narrative.
Chalamet is absolutely adored by everyone. He really, really gets it. Even those that are iffy or half and half about the film, they all think he's great. Now, how can he get
He looks good. He looks good in the film. I'll give him this credit. I haven't liked him in since Call Me By Your Name, but he does look good in this film, and he does look like he's doing a very good impression, but also giving a performance within that impression. Ultimately, I just feel like he's early, like mid-2000s or early 2000s DiCaprio, and I think they're just going to make him wait.
Oh, okay. Too young, in other words. Just like they're not going to give the best actress to Mikey Madison, even though she's overwhelmingly... No question about it. She's just incandescent in my eyes. She's real. She's fierce. She's, you know, you can feel her. You can sense what she's going through at every second. I just thought it was brilliant. And just because she's 25, they're going to say, all right, that's fine. Now just wait until you're 35 or maybe even 40. Then we'll... I fucking hate that. I hate that attitude.
But I think another thing about Mikey Madison is you had Jennifer Lawrence, and Jennifer Lawrence, you know, you could just impose into any number of different projects and roles and types of vehicles for her.
Yeah.
With Mikey Madison, I think there's going to be a little bit of the skepticism of, okay, you know, what's going to be next, and can she, you know, become a star? Because I think they just want to if they're going to anoint a young actress, they're going to anoint her to be Queen of Hollywood or a big star. And I think they might be hesitant to anoint a young actress if, you know, she doesn't necessarily fit into a box.
Do you think that you mentioned Jennifer Lawrence? You know, she hasn't really lucked into or tied into anything since Silver Linings Playbook that really.
No, she hasn't. She hasn't
been
really.
Like 10 years, even, over 10 years.
Yeah, yeah. Same thing with Brie Larson. In sense that Brie Larson like just has not given a single interesting performance.
Yeah.
Since that particular film, and you didn't even like that film. I don't think she's given an interesting performance since then, and I don't. It felt like okay, she's on TV and in film up until then, she'd given a number of different varied characterizations that were all interesting and all compelling and very textured. But after that, she just went into Hollywood mode, and she just did a whole bunch of big films that were none of which were interesting.
Right.
So I think for that reason, they're going to be skeptical of Mikey Madison and just like, okay, what else do you have?
Oh, that's, what a shitty world, honestly. You know, I think that movie awards should be about things that people commonly agree really work and they score. And you can feel it. You just can feel it when you watch it. That's all. And I know, I don't care what any of the know-it-all say. I know that Emilia Perez did not deliver. You can just take a step back and say, well, look how ambitious it is, and look what they did. They created a musical about a very unlikely-sounding plot. Does anybody really believe that a Mexican drug cartel kingpin would want to go for, you know, changing his gender and becoming a woman as a way of escaping or leaving behind the former life? I think that's one of the stupidest ideas I've ever heard, that anybody would take that idea seriously. If you know anything about the culture of Mexico and what you have to do to stay alive and stay on top of that brutal, horrific, cartel game, which is not, you know, it's not a corporation. It's not, it's a rough and tumble business involving murder and threats and, you know, the cops on you all the time. I just don't believe it for a second. Not 1 second. But everybody was so, you should have been there in Cannes when it first started. And people were just euphoric about the idea of a trans woman playing a real woman and maybe getting, you know, I mean, people were just like knocked out. It was like there's a kind of a levitational feeling, you know, amongst certain journalists and certain people in the crowd. And it was, that's why the jury decided, well, let's include her. And they gave it to Sofia, Carla Sofia Gascon. And now I'm trying to remember who else got it. Was it the entire cast of Emilia, the women in
the cast? Yeah, the four women, yeah. So yeah. Saldana Gomez and Adriana Paz, I think her name is.
I really do love
Get used to it. This is the reality, because we could have. But what about? How would you respond to the Brutalists, say, winning?
I would be just like I'd almost want to. I mean, I would feel probably as badly about that as I did about Everything Everywhere All at Once winning the Best Picture. I thought I was disgusted by that whole thing, and I still think it's one of the most overpraised films, and I'd feel like, you know, I guess that there's a certain vibe, a certain feeling that you get from films that really do deliver and they touch you. I mean, I'm not talking about the ambition of it, but you know, they actually work. You can feel them working, and I don't, that idea seems to not be, you know, you can step back and say, look at how hard they worked, and how, what a novel idea, and boy, that you can. But when you're right in and watching the damn thing, it's different. It really is. And either people understand or agree with you that there is something really happening, when you watch Conclave and you watch Anora and you watch even Complete Unknown, you can feel it actually working. It's not an arcane concept. It's something that you can actually feel it connecting with you deep down, an emotional thing. And there's just doesn't seem to be a lot of empathy or feeling for that type of thing. You know, I guess it's like
I think people are now really just responding to. There's a certain kind of critic that just loves the quote unquote big swing.
Yeah, I get that. The Brutals
is a big swing. That's what they're responding to.
Yeah.
There are certain commentators, specifically Sean Fennessy at the Ringer, where I defy him to explain that he actually truly loves The Brutalist, even though he named it his favorite film of the year or the best film of the year. I defy him to explain that he truly loves it. I think he's as frustrated with the second half as pretty much everyone else.
Yeah.
But they're just obsessed with the quote unquote big swing. Mm-hmm. That's why Mank was had such a had that kind of respect as well.
Yeah. Well, I think that is a term and a phrase that resonates, and I agree with you. Big swing is always respected, and I'm not going to dispute, and I understand that. But let me just point out something that happened last November. That's only 2 months ago. But I think that, I tried to point this out when it happened. In a shift from 2020, this New York Times story said, identity politics loses its grip on the country. And subhead being, there are signs that society is moving away from the progressive left's often strict expectations about how to discuss culture and politics. I think that if New York Times and this one particular writer and a sociologist that he quotes, I think that's definitely happening. I can feel the change in the weather, the change in the winds. And you said, there's some people that are very attached to what not just the big swing, but what Emilia Perez is saying about culture and sexuality and gender and all the things that the progressive left. People don't want to hear that shit. They really don't. I mean, it's like you're saying that it's something that's really humming and really has people churn out. I don't think so. Unless Holly wants to say, fuck the rest of the country, and this is who we are. We're an industry, and this is what we think. This is what we believe. This is what turns us on. And if people in Des Moines or in Virginia or Tampa or up in Maine don't agree with me, fuck them. We don't care. We're going to this is our business. This is our industry. It's our culture. And we're going to go with what moves us. I think that they are, they're going to have to have a reckoning and ask themselves, do they really want to be perceived by the general public as often their own little, little corner, little realm, what do you think about that? What do you think about the way
I would
think?
I would say that with that comment, there is the perception that it is up to Hollywood or the coast, etc., to be more empathetic. Mm-hmm. Towards people in the center of the country. I think that's the thinking, but or towards Trump voters and to but all I've seen in terms of mm-hmm. what has happened in terms of the Palisades fires mm-hmm. is there's no sense of harmony or wrapping their arms around Hollywood or even people who just live in that area. So there is this idea that, okay, these people need to be more empathetic towards the Hollywood and the Academy needs to be empathetic towards Trump voters, but I don't see Trump voters being empathetic towards people who've just lost their houses and their workplaces and their neighbors' places. So I think that's a complicated question that you've
One thing that people on the progressive left always say is that people who are trans, people even just plain old LGBTQ, they're threatened. Their lives are being threatened. They always say that. And I'm not saying that there's not some real fiends out there who live to hate people that aren't straight or, you know, hate people that want to change their gender. But I don't ever feel this. I don't ever hear it. I don't ever sense this kind of loathing for people who are, you know, not part of the mainstream, you know. I say it all the time, and I don't really believe it. I don't think that people are that venal out there in the middle of the country. I think that there's a whole, like Bill Maher said, there's a whole huge, sensible, practical-minded, they're not crazy, they're not hate-driven, they're just, you know, they just think that the progressive left has gone mental the last 5-6 years, and they're really sick of it. And there's a part of me that understands that, at least. I mean, I don't want to get into a thing and about the prevalence.
No. But I did hear similar things in your discussion with Sasha earlier this week. Yeah.
What was the discussion? Which one are you referring to?
Your podcast that you uploaded earlier this week, definitely. And she definitely was drawing comparison to a lot of what you were saying with you know, Amelia Perez. But I just have to reiterate that Amelia Perez is in some ways in the center, and here's how: because you've got the Trump style voter who just would despise it on sight and just hates right. everything that it sort of represents, and then you've got the extreme left as represented by certain critics and certain figures on film Twitter right. who just despise it because it's not progressive enough and it's not this enough and it's not that enough, and you know Odiard needs to be this and he needs to be that and he can't be talking about this because he's not that, et cetera, et cetera. So it is in some ways stuck in the middle. So that's why I do think that both SAG and PGA might respond to it. I think with PGA, I think it's just between Amelia Perez and the Brutalist. And I think it's...
I think discounting Conclave. It's just forget it. Not a chance. It's not. Cause it's too popcorn,
I think Conclave is well liked, but I don't think it has necessarily that passion that is going to propel it. I think you can, as you mentioned with the Cannes reception, there was passion for Amelia Perez and in rewarding those actresses. I imagine there might be similar passion with the SAG vote, but. I liked Conclave. The thing about Conclave is I saw it and I was like, I like this. This is very good. This is a sort of a 4-star film. I wonder what else is next. And then I saw the films that were next, and then I was like, oh geez, let's get back to Conclave. So so I think that might happen with certain voters. They might have seen Conclave like, this is very good. This is a very good thriller, and think what are we going to see next, and then sort of circle back. But I don't think there's necessarily going to be that passion because I don't think that initial response was as extreme as the response for the Brutalist. I think the Brutalist does have a certain response. I think it's a shallow response. I think it's expressed by shallow people of this is a serious film because it's about serious events and, you know, look how serious Brady Corbett looks and he doesn't shave and he doesn't cut his hair. Look, he's a very serious guy. I think Conclave is just seen as a very polished entertainment. I think we need polished entertainment. I'd like to see well-made entertainment more often, but it's just seen in that respect, and it's respected for that. But you know, as you mentioned with the Brutalist, the budget and all that kind of thing, the difficulties, producers are going to respond to that.
Let's wrap up our conversation with a discussion of the just deceased David Lynch, who, I didn't realize that he talked late last year about being beset by emphysema, bad emphysema, because he's never apparently stopped smoking. And the writing was on the wall for the poor guy. But something about the fires, he had to abandon one of his homes or something about the, I don't know what it was, but the trauma of having to move out of a house or having to leave where he was living. He apparently owned three places, one on Mulholland and two nearby. Anyway, he passed not long after the fires started to really shake things up in that town. And here's the thing that people are saying, what a huge, huge loss. Well, I felt that immediately. Who didn't? But it's the idea of him not being part of the world. Even if he didn't have another great film in him, or even an interesting film, I feel badly about him not being here. He's been part of the intellectual conversation or the artistic conversation, the cinematic conversation for 40 years since Eraserhead, since Elephant Man, since you have to allow that Dune happened, even though that was a mistake on his part or it didn't work. But it was when you look at Blue Velvet, at the very least, I think that basically what he did was he really owned the 80s. That was really his time. And very few artists, very few creators just keep moving right along and keep firing, bullseyes, It doesn't work that way, usually. Although he, when you think about it, lasted a full, 20 years, if you go from Eraserhead to Mulholland Drive, which I think is a major film. So he was really quite the steam engine, the powerful, turbine. But I don't think he had a lot of ideas. He said as much over the last, say, 20. He said at one point, this is in 14, I didn't print this, but I found it. He said, I've got fragments. I've got fragments, but I haven't got the big idea. It just isn't coming to me. And I'm kind of, sifting through and thinking about what big idea can I put together for a film. And I don't think that it ever came to him. I don't think that he was really... I mean, he's always been an interesting fellow, and he's always had edgy things to point out or currents. Or things that kind of get to people in a kind of an odd way, but I think he basically just said, call him a huge loss, at least as far as the last 15, 20 years. I don't think so. I think he had those two great decades, and then it lessened for him. He didn't have the power and the glory in him this century. But like what I said today, what I loved about him was his getting pissed off at things. That was great. I loved his John Ford. I loved that whole thing. So,
I think he's someone who had who did variations of a theme. And you look at Lost Highway, and you look at the structural similarities to Mulholland Drive, and they're very similar. Yeah. But he would find ways of refreshing himself and refreshing his perspective on the world with sort of interesting variations of what he previously did. I would put in the same bracket David Cronenberg and Pedro Almodovar. They make different kinds of films, but in some ways, but in other ways, they return to certain themes. They return to certain ideas, which they sort of explore throughout. To me, what I felt was with David Lynch and that particular generation, the generation after the 70s movie brats, that particular generation, the 80s generation, were the ones who truly took up the mantle of what it means to be an auteur, especially in respect to what to Andrew Sarris's perspective and writings. And, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I think they were truly the auteurs. In a way, you cannot tell me that Francis Ford Coppola making Peggy Sue Got Married and Dracula and Jack and all these things. They were just like, he's just throwing spaghetti against the wall.
Yeah.
Whilst
in
some ways, Cronenberg and Lynch and Jane Campion and a number of different filmmakers, Jim Jarmusch, you can actually, that is a true body of work that they've actually constructed that feels like an authorship in a way that
you mentioned,
don't necessarily.
Sarris. Yeah, I remember him very specifically and very clearly. When I happened to have a car ride up with him, I took him up to a theater. He was basically a guest at the Westport Country Playhouse, and I remember I picked him up in Manhattan and took him back. I remember him saying something that always stuck with me, which is that most artists, and the really good ones including, I mean, they only have so much psychic essence, is how he said. And you're drawing from, you know, life experience, you're drawing from feelings that it were probably, you know, created in your childhood. But there's only so much of that. It's not an endless, supply. You can, like, as you say with Lynch, you can kind of refresh it and come at it a different way. But basically, there's only so much you can do with what you feel, what is the way the life has impacted you. So, I don't know.
Yeah, and you certainly feel like, you know, with the last couple of David Cronenberg films, for instance, you're like, okay, we've seen this sort of thing before.
Yeah,
at the same time, you appreciate the fact that they've actually truly got that body of work in a way that, you know, we all love William Friedkin, but, you know, you look at that quote-unquote body of work, and it's just some really exciting films in the 70s and then just sort of whatever, some good films, some mostly not so good films, but it's just like there's no vision that you can actually point to and say that's authorship.
Yeah,
that's just, you know, craftsmanship.
Yeah,
they became craftsmen. Even, and this might annoy people, even people like, you know, Coppola and even Scorsese. Even Scorsese has that tendency to just sort of just do all these big, big projects, and they're all big, big, big. Mm. They're just not as interesting as what he did in the 70s and the 80s. They're just not.
No.
They're not truer reflections of who he is and what his sensibility is. Mm. You know, The Aviator, very good film, but that's not really, I don't really feel as if that's connected to him in a deep way, The Departed, et cetera, et cetera. Whilst you look at Lynch's films,
he was remaking, obviously, Hong Kong film, but I felt it from him. I felt the Scorsese.
Yeah.
I loved the way music was worked in The Departed. That was really that got me.
But do you feel the same way about Hugo, about Silence, about his latest film? No, they're all just throwing spaghetti at the wall.
Yeah.
And some are very great films, and The Departed is a great film, but there's that lack of connection, that lack of through line that Lynch had. So we're paying tribute to David Lynch by shitting on other filmmakers, but he's a great man of the cinema, and he was a great man apparently as well in his personal dealings. So. What a loss.
All right, man. We've done an hour. Let's not overstay our welcome.
Perfect.
But I made two recordings because I found that for some strange reason, loading a full hour's worth of MP3 or WAV sound takes forever and it blocks. But I've done it correctly. So I stopped the recording in the middle of one of our conversations and I started it right up again, so it should work out. So anyway,
sounds perfect.
But I will take that phrase with me, that term, which is big swing. I think I can't dispute that is something that always impresses people, and you're right. So that'll be the title of this of this
perfect. Perfect.
Post,
sounds good.
Yeah.
All right,
man.
All right.
Enjoy life. Let's talk again soon.
Absolutely. All right. Bye.
Take care. Bye.